readers, welcome to the Book Report and a very happy new year. I'm Elaine Charles, and as your host, I feel duty-bound to take a literary look back at 2011. First, this week we'll spotlight the women who've populated the bestseller lists. In fact, in researching this week's show, I came upon a fascinating article in Forbes magazine from this past June. It was the 10 most powerful women authors. Topping the list, no surprise, J.K. Rowling, the genius creator of Harry Potter, 450 million books sold. Danielle Steele follows with 800 million books sold. Wow. Third on the list, Toni Morrison, then Stephanie Meyer of Twilight fame. Next are Mary Higgins Clark, author of 42 books, each a bestseller, Maya Angelou, and Alice Walker, the first African-American woman to win a Pulitzer Prize. Rounding out Forbes' list is Jhumpa Lahiri, whose debut short story collection, Interpreter of Maladies, won a Pulitzer Prize for fiction in 1999. Completing the list are Joyce Carol Oates and, finally, Isabel Allende. And to keep the ladies in the forefront, we'll be hearing from two wonderful women I met at the Miami International Book Fair. Both have new books out on women in the arts. So much to cover. Let's turn now to page one of the book report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Before writing this week's show, I shamefully admit I was not familiar with the work of Jhumpa Lahiri. In Unaccustomed Earth, Lahiri tells eight stories that take us from Cambridge and Seattle to India and Thailand. In the title story, Ruma, a young mother in a new city, is visited by her father, who carefully tends her garden, where he and his grandson form a very special bond. But he is harboring a secret from his daughter, a love affair he's keeping all to himself. In A Choice of Accommodations, a husband's attempt to turn an old friend's wedding into a romantic getaway weekend with his wife takes a dark, revealing turn as the party lasts deep into the night. And in a trio of linked stories, we follow the lives of a girl and boy who, one winter, share a house in Massachusetts. They travel from innocence to experience on separate, sometimes painful paths until destiny brings them together again years later in Rome. Lahiri's enormous gifts as a storyteller are on full display in this collection, performed by Zarita Choudhury and A.J. Naidu.
The calls were less frequent now, normally once a week on Sunday afternoons. "You're always welcome here, Baba," she told her father on the phone. "You know you don't have to ask." Her mother would not have asked. "We're coming to see you in July," she would have informed Ruma, the plane tickets already in hand. There had been a time in her life when such presumptuousness would have angered Ruma. She missed it now. Adam would be away that week, on another business trip. He worked for a hedge fund and since the move had yet to spend two consecutive weeks at home. Tagging along with him wasn't an option. He never went anywhere interesting, usually towns in the Northwest or Canada, where there was nothing special for her and Akash to do. In a few months, Adam assured her the trips would diminish. He hated stranding Ruma with Akash so often, he said, especially now that she was pregnant again. He encouraged her to hire a babysitter, even a live-in, if that would be helpful. But Ruma knew no one in Seattle, and the prospect of finding someone to care for her child in a strange place seemed more daunting than looking after him on her own. It was just a matter of getting through the summer. In September, Akash would start at a preschool. Besides, Ruma wasn't working and couldn't justify paying for something she now had the freedom to do. In New York, after Akash was born, she'd negotiated a part-time schedule at her law firm, spending Thursdays and Fridays at home in Park Slope. And this had seemed like the perfect balance. The firm had been tolerant at first, but it had not been so easy, dealing with her mother's death just as an important case was about to go to trial. She had died on the operating table of heart failure. Anesthesia for routine gallstone surgery had triggered anaphylactic shock. After the 2 weeks Ruma received for bereavement, she couldn't face going back. Overseeing her clients' futures, preparing their wills and refinancing their mortgages, felt ridiculous to her, and all she wanted was to stay home with Akash, not just Thursdays and Fridays, but every day. And then, miraculously, Adam's new job came through, with a salary generous enough for her to give notice. It was the house that was her work now, leafing through the piles of catalogs that came in the mail, marking them with post-its, ordering sheets covered with dragons for Akash's room. "Perfect," Adam said, when Ruma told him about her father's visit. "He'll be able to help you out while I'm gone." But Ruma disagreed. It was her mother who would have been the helpful one, taking over the kitchen, singing songs to Akash and teaching him Bengali nursery rhymes, throwing loads of laundry into the machine. Ruma had never spent a week alone with her father. When her parents visited her in Brooklyn, after Akash was born, her father claimed an armchair in the living room, quietly combing through the Times, occasionally tucking a finger under the baby's chin, but behaving as if he were waiting for the time to pass. Her father lived alone now, made his own meals. She could not picture his surroundings when they spoke on the phone. He'd moved into a one-bedroom condominium in a part of Pennsylvania Ruma did not know well. He had pared down his possessions and sold the house where Ruma and her younger brother Romy had spent their childhood, informing them only after he and the buyer went into contract. It hadn't made a difference to Romy, who'd been living in New Zealand for the past 2 years, working on the crew of a German documentary filmmaker. Ruma knew that the house, with the rooms her mother had decorated, and the bed in which she liked to sit up doing crossword puzzles, and the stove on which she'd cooked, was too big for her father now. Still, the news had been shocking, wiping out her mother's presence just as the surgeon had. She knew her father did not need taken care of, and yet this very fact caused her to feel guilty. In India, there would have been no question of his not moving in with her. Her father had never mentioned the possibility, and after her mother's death, it hadn't been feasible. Their old apartment was too small. But in Seattle, there were rooms to spare, rooms that stood empty and without purpose. Ruma feared that her father would become a responsibility, an added demand, continuously present in a way she was no longer used to. It would mean an end to the family she'd created on her own, herself and Adam and Akash, and the second child that would come in January, conceived just before the move. She couldn't imagine tending to her father as her mother had, serving the meals her mother used to prepare. Still, not offering him a place in her home made her feel worse. It was a dilemma Adam didn't understand. Whenever she brought up the issue, he pointed out the obvious, that she already had a small child to care for, another on the way. He reminded her that her father was in good health for his age, content where he was.
That was Unaccustomed Earth by Jhumpa Lahiri. Salomon is the author of 6 books, including The Devil's Candy, considered a Hollywood classic about filmmaking gone awry. She was born in Ohio, graduated from Tufts and NYU Law School. Salomon was reporter and film critic for The Wall Street Journal for many years, and then became a culture writer on the staff of The New York Times. Her novella, The Christmas Tree, was a New York Times bestseller and has been translated into 8 languages. Julie's work has also appeared in The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, Vogue, Bazaar, and The New Republic. She now lives in Manhattan. Today, we're going to be speaking with her about her latest book, Wendy and the Lost Boys. It's about Wendy Wasserstein, who won a Pulitzer Prize and was the first woman playwright to win a Tony Award. Wasserstein wrote 11 plays during her lifetime, which explore topics ranging from feminism to family, ethnicity to pop culture. They include The Heidi Chronicles, The Sisters Rosenzweig, An American Daughter, Old Money, and more. In addition to her Tony Award and a Pulitzer Prize, Wendy won a New York Drama Critics Circle Award, a Drama Desk Award, and an Outer Critics Circle Award. Wendy also wrote the screenplay for the 98 film The Object of My Affection, which starred Jennifer Aniston and Paul Rudd. Wasserstein is described as an author of woman identity crises. Her heroines, intelligent, successful, are riddled with self-doubt. Their hard-earned sense of self-worth was often shadowed by frustrating knowledge that American women's lives continued to be measured by their success at capturing the right man. Wasserstein commented that her parents allowed her to go to Yale only because they were certain she would meet an eligible lawyer there, get married, and lead a conventional life. Wasserstein gave birth to a daughter, Lucy Jane Wasserstein, on September 12, 1999, when she was 48. The child's difficult birth was 3 months premature and is recorded in her collection of essays, Schick's a Goddess. Wasserstein, who was not married, never publicly identified her daughter's father. Wendy was hospitalized with lymphoma in December 2005 and died on January 30, 2006. The news of her death was unexpected because her illness had not been widely publicized. The night after she died, Broadway's lights were dimmed in her honor. Welcome, Julie. Thanks so much for stopping by the Book Report, and congratulations on your great reviews.
Thank you very much.
In your capacity as critic for the Wall Street Journal and culture writer for the New York Times, I'm assuming you knew Wendy?
Actually, I didn't. I met Wendy in the course of doing this book.
Oh, you met her while compiling all the interviews.
Well, I didn't meet her literally. Yeah. I met her spiritually, I guess.
All right. Your book was based on more than 300 interviews. How long did it take you to write it and research it?
The whole process took about 2.5 years from start to almost finish.
Yeah. And what members of her immediate family did you actually have the opportunity to interview?
I interviewed her sister, Georgette, her brother, Bruce, who sadly died 6 weeks after I interviewed him. And then I spoke to a lot of her nieces and nephews and cousins. So almost everybody who was left alive in her family, I spoke to.
Now, her siblings were pretty successful in their own rights. Can you talk about that?
Yes, her oldest sister, Sandra, who was quite a bit older than Wendy, was the first woman to become a high-level executive at both Citibank and at American Express. That was back in the 60s when women didn't achieve those kinds of positions. And then Wendy became a Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright in the late 80s, and her brother Bruce became a billionaire, the chairman of Lazard Frere, which is a big investment banking advisor.
And all with what seemed like a pretty terrible mother. Do you want to talk about that a bit?
Well, Lola Wasserstein was a wonderful and terrible mother. She was somebody who thought her children were the best who existed, but nothing they did was good enough. And I think that combination of that they were better than everybody else, but what they did wasn't quite as good as they could do, really pushed them to be successful, but also, I think, kept them from being entirely happy.
Talk about the kind of unknown brother, Abner.
Abner was the fifth Wasserstein sibling. When I started working on the book, I read Wendy Wasserstein's obituaries, and half of them said there were four siblings, and half of the obituaries said there were five. And the fifth was Abner, who was born a normal kid, and then when he was about five, got ill and started having seizures, and he became what we would now call developmentally disabled. And his parents kept him at home for a while, but before Wendy was born, they put him in a special school. And the parents continued to visit him throughout their lives, but he became a secret. Wendy never met him until she was almost 50 years old.
Now, was Wendy really named for the Peter Pan character?
Honest and truly. Her older sister, Sandy, loved the Peter Pan story. She named Wendy after Wendy.
it.
Okay.
She wasn't the only one.
Wendy was born in 1950, and if you look at the spike in the name Wendy, after Mary Martin played Peter Pan on Broadway, and then it was broadcast on television, the number of Wendys grew exponentially, and Wendy was one of those Wendys.
I know. When I was a kid, we used to wait for that once-a-year showing on TV.
Me, too. I grew up. I used to know the entire score, which I will spare you. I won't sing it for you.
Now, Wendy did go to Yale, and did she actually know Meryl Streep and Sigourney Weaver at that time?
She did. She was at the Yale Drama School in the mid-1970s, and Meryl Streep and Sigourney Weaver were a year and 2 years ahead of her, but they were definitely part of the group of people. It was a small program, and Wendy was one of the few women playwrights there, so everybody knew everybody.
And I know that when she came to New York, she had colleagues at the Playwrights Horizons. Talk about that.
Well, when Wendy started her career, Playwrights Horizons became her main producer. And at the time, Christopher Durang was there. James Lapine, who now directs and writes a lot of Stephen Sondheim's plays. Terrence McNally, who's a very well-known playwright, was there. William Finn, who's extremely well-known. He did the Spelling Bee play, the Putnam County Spelling Bee, and many other funny musicals. So it was just this confluence of talent in the 80s. And the book is partly about that baby boom theater generation as well.
Wendy seemed like such a larger-than-life person, yet she was so very private. Frank Rich, her great friend and former theater critic and columnist for The Times, wrote after her death, "How could the most public artist in New York keep so much locked up? Why?"
Wow, you just picked out the line in the book that was the reason I wanted to write this biography, because Wendy Wasserstein wrote these plays that seemed very autobiographical. She wrote essays that revealed everything, or seemed to. You know, she gave birth to her daughter, and 2 seconds later, she's at the typewriter or the computer screen writing an article about it. And yet, after she died, all of her friends found out that she had kept them all sort of in compartments. She told this to one and that to the other, but her inner self she kept very secret. And I think a lot of it had to do with Abner, the brother who had been kept away from the family. I think, you know, Wendy would always joke that in their family, when somebody died, they would say, oh, they went to Europe. So she was raised on this atmosphere of secrecy and not telling. And I think she internalized it, and that became how she lived her life.
Why do you think the Heidi Chronicles was the runaway success that it was?
Because I think Wendy put her finger on sort of a lot of the issues that women of her generation in particular, the baby boom generation, were grappling with. She went to college between 1967 and 1971. She was at Mount Holyoke College. And during those 4 years, everything really changed for women. When she entered Mount Holyoke, they had to come home by a certain hour. They had to wear a certain kind of clothes. They had to dress for dinner. By the time they left, it was, you know, open season on anything. And in other colleges, it was co-ed dorms. I mean, everything changed. And I think that with the Heidi Chronicles, Wendy Wasserstein, when she wrote it, was in her late 30s, and she had become a successful playwright, but she wasn't married. She didn't have children. She hadn't figured out how do you balance having a successful career and having a family. And I think those were a lot of the issues she was confronting at a moment in time when her whole generation was confronting them one way or another. And I think she was saying on stage what a lot of women were thinking and feeling but were afraid to say. And I think she just hit a nerve in the zeitgeist, and that's what caused it to be such a big success.
I know. I'm personally interested. What has happened with her daughter? She was a single mom, so who's actually raising her daughter?
Yeah, well, that's a really sad story, because Wendy was 48 when she had her daughter, and then within a year, she Wendy, became quite ill. And for really most of Lucy Jane's life with Wendy was getting sicker and sicker, and she died when Lucy Jane was only 5, just about to turn 6. And so Lucy Jane went to live with Bruce Wasserstein, Wendy's brother, together, and his third wife, Claude Wasserstein, a year later, they got divorced. And so Lucy Jane and her two stepbrothers, who were also her cousins, went back and forth between the two of them, and then Bruce died. But in between, he married a fourth wife. Anyway, Lucy Jane's living with the third wife, Claude, who I think is quite a good mother. So she's had a big childhood, and she's only 12.
That must be tough. I can only imagine she'll be writing soon, too.
Right, that's what I thought. She's going to have her own story to tell.
And what are you working on now? This book is wildly successful. So what's next for you?
Well, I'm just starting to map out a book that I want to write that I'm not going to tell you because I'm highly superstitious. And if it doesn't work out, I don't want to have you beat me over the head with it. But I'm looking at a story about the relationship between a very old person and a very young person, because I think there's something about that generational transfer that I'm quite interested in. And it kind of carries forward a lot of the themes of Wendy Wasserstein's life, because I think she was thinking a lot about what our lives mean. And what is it that matters in our life? And what do you leave behind for the people who come after you?
Well, I know I'll be anxiously looking forward to it. Thank you so much for joining us today. And best of luck with your new book.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to have talked to you.
Alice LaPlante's Turn of Mind is a spellbinding novel high up on Amazon's 2011 Mystery and Thriller list. It follows the disintegration of a strong woman's mind and the unhinging of her family. Dr. Jennifer White, recently widowed and a newly retired orthopedic surgeon, is entering the early stages of dementia, where the impossibility of recognizing reality can be both a blessing and a curse. As the story opens, Jennifer's lifelong friend and neighbor, Amanda, has been killed and four fingers surgically removed. Dr. White is the prime suspect in the murder. She herself doesn't know if she did it or not. Narrated in her voice, a picture emerges of the surprisingly intimate, complex alliance between this pair, two proud, forceful women who were, at times, each other's most formidable adversaries. The women's 30-year friendship deeply entangled their families, and as the narrative unfolds, we see that things were not always as they seemed. As the investigation intensifies, a chilling question persists. Is Dr. Jennifer White's shattered memory preventing her from revealing the truth, or helping her to hide it? Told through the voice of a woman with a powerful intellect that is slipping away, Turn of the Mind is a suspenseful psychological thriller that pulses with intensity. Jean Reed Bale narrates.
I have dementia. My son Mark is 29. My daughter Fiona, 24. A caregiver, Magdalena, lives with me. It is all clear. So who are all these other people in my house? People, strangers, everywhere. A blonde woman I don't recognize in my kitchen drinking tea. A glimpse of movement from the den. Then I turn the corner into the living room and find yet another face. I ask, so who are you? Who are all the others? Do you know her? I point to the kitchen and they laugh. I am her, they say. I was there, now I'm here. I am the only one in the house other than you. They ask if I want tea. They ask if I want to go for a walk. Am I a baby, I say. I am tired of the questions. You know me, don't you? Don't you remember? Magdalena, your friend. The notebook is a way of communicating with myself and with others, of filling in the blank periods. When all is in a fog, when someone refers to an event or conversation that I can't recall, I leaf through the pages. Sometimes it comforts me to read what's there. Sometimes not. It is my Bible of consciousness. It lives on the kitchen table, large and square, with an embossed leather cover and heavy, creamy paper. Each entry has a date on it. A nice lady sits me down in front of it. She writes, January 20, 2009. Jennifer's notes. She hands the pen to me. She says, "Write what happened today. Write about your childhood. Write whatever you remember." I remember my first wrist arthrodesis, the pressure of scalpel against skin, the slight give when it finally sliced through, the resilience of muscle, my surgical scissors scraping bone, and afterward, peeling off bloody gloves finger by finger. Black. Everyone is wearing black. They're walking in twos and threes down the street towards St. Vincent's, bundled in coats and scarves that cover their heads and lower faces against what is apparently bitter wind. I am inside my warm house, my face to the frosted window, Magdalena hovering. I can just see the 12-foot carved wooden doors. They are wide open, and people are entering. A hearse is standing in front. Other cars lined up behind it, their lights on. "It's Amanda," Magdalena tells me. "Amanda's funeral." "Where's Amanda?" I ask. Magdalena hesitates, then says, "Your best friend. Your daughter's godmother." I try. I fail. I shake my head. Magdalena gets my notebook. She turns back the pages. She points to a newspaper clipping. "Elderly Chicago woman found dead, mutilated." Chicago Tribune, February 23, 2009. Chicago, Illinois. "The mutilated body of a 75-year-old Chicago woman was discovered yesterday in a house in the 2100 block of Sheffield Avenue. Amanda O'Toole was found dead in her home after a neighbor noticed she had failed to take in her newspapers for almost a week, according to sources close to the investigation. Four fingers on her right hand had been severed. The exact time of death is unknown, but cause of death is attributed to head trauma, sources say. Nothing was reported missing from her house. No one has been charged, but police briefly took into custody and then released a person of interest in the case."
We've just heard a preview of Turn of Mind by Alice LaPlante. Daughter of Smoke and Bone by Lainey Taylor made Amazon's Best Books of 2011 list. Meet Karu. She fills her sketchbooks with monsters that may or may not be real. She's prone to disappearing on mysterious errands. She speaks many languages, not all of them human. And her bright blue hair is her natural shade. Who is she? When a stranger, Akiva, fixes his fire-colored eyes on her in an alley in Marrakesh, the result is blood and starlight, secrets unveiled, and a star-crossed love whose roots are deep in a violent past. Christine Hovham narrates.
It seemed like just another Monday. Innocent, but for its essential mundaneness, not to mention its Januariness. It was cold, and it was dark. In the dead of winter, the sun didn't rise until 8. But it was also lovely. The falling snow in the early hour conspired to paint Prague ghostly, like a tintype photograph, all silver and haze. On the riverfront thoroughfare, trams and buses roared past, grounding the day in the 21st century. But on the quieter lanes, the wintry peace might have hailed from another time. Snow and stone and ghostlight. Karu's own footsteps and the feather of steam from her coffee mug. And she was alone and adrift in mundane thoughts. School. Errands. The occasional cheek chew of bitterness when a pang of heartache intruded, as pangs of heartache will. But she pushed them aside, resolute, ready to be done with all that. She held her coffee mug in one hand and clutched her coat closed with the other. An artist's portfolio was slung over her shoulder, and her hair, loose, long, and peacock blue, was gathering a lace of snowflakes. Just another day. And then, a snarl, rushing footfall, and she was seized from behind, pulled hard against a man's broad chest as hands yanked her scarf askew, and she felt teeth. Teeth against her neck. Nibbling. Her attacker was nibbling her. Annoyed, she tried to shake him off without spilling her coffee, but some sloshed out of her cup anyway, into the dirty snow. "Kaz, get off!" she snapped, spinning to face her ex-boyfriend. The lamplight was soft on his beautiful face. "Stupid beauty," she thought, shoving him away. "Stupid face." "How did you know it was me?" he asked. "It's always you, and it never works." Casimir made his living jumping out from behind things, and it frustrated him that he could never get even the slightest rise out of Carew.
"You're impossible to scare," he complained, giving her the pout he thought was irresistible.
Until recently, she wouldn't have resisted it. She would have risen on tiptoe and licked his pout-puckered lower lip, licked it languorously, and then taken it between her teeth and teased it before losing herself in a kiss that made her melt against him like sun-warmed honey. Those days were so over. "Maybe you're just not scary," she said, and walked on. Kaz caught up and strolled at her side, hands in pockets.
"I am scary, though. The snarl? The bite? Anyone normal would have a heart attack. Just not you. Ice water for blood."
When she ignored him, he added,
"Joseph and I are starting a new tour. Old Town Vampire Tour. The tourists will eat it up."
That was Daughter of Smoke and Bone by Lainey Taylor. George Sand, the 19th century author, is a story unto herself. She was a French woman who wore men's clothes, smoked cigars, and slept with Chopin. Her great subject was love, her recurring theme, the legal inequities for women in marriage. She wrote numerous novels, plays, political essays, travel books, journals, and brilliant letters, the most famous to Flaubert. Her admirers included Balzac, Dostoevsky, Walt Whitman, and Charlotte Bronte. Now, Rosalind Brackenberry brings us Becoming George Sand and resurrects the author's story with a parallel story in present day. As the novel opens in Edinburgh, Maria is reading the 19th century writer's autobiography and, like Sand before her, having an extramarital affair with a younger man. Rosalind Brackenberry was born in London, grew up in the south of England, earned a history degree at Cambridge, and has lived in Scotland and France. She now lives in Key West. She worked as a book reviewer from 1994 to 2006, newspaper columnist, and was a writer in residence at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg. Welcome, Rosalind. Congratulations on your book, and thanks for stopping by the Book Report.
Well, thank you.
Your book's been called an impressionistic portrait of Sand. Wow, that's great praise.
Yes, right. I was pleased.
So why George Sand? Why now?
Well, I think she's got a lot to say to modern women. I mean, she always did have, but she's an extraordinarily contemporary voice and dealing in her life with a lot of the things that we're still dealing with that we all thought we would, you know, deal with easily. But so I think she's an encouraging person for modern women to read and to think about.
How much research did you actually do? How long did it take you to sort of understand her life?
Well, I did a lot of research on her quite a long time ago. This book took me forever to write. I started reading her a long time ago, and I went to, I read a lot of her and her letters, and also went to her houses in France and went to Mallorca where she was with Chopin, which comes into the book. So quite a bit, but in a relaxed sort of way. You know, I wasn't rushing around focusing on George Sand. I just kept kind of thinking about her for a long time.
For those readers who aren't familiar with her work, what would you recommend as a good introductory novel of hers to read?
Oh, she wrote so many. I like her story of my life very much because that tells you all about her. I mean, some of her novels are better than others, but she wrote for money and she was a big success in her day. So she was sometimes, you can say, they were slightly potboilers and sometimes they were wonderfully good. I mean, she always was a good writer, but others, I don't know what's translated into English now. I think people should just go online and see what they can find and, you know, see what of hers is available. I know her story of my life is in English, and that's a very good, interesting one to begin with. There's a shortened version. You don't have to read through 5 or 6 volumes as I did.
I'm not a fan of abridgments, but...
no, quite. But yeah. I think the English translation is a shortened version.
Was she criticized in her life for her numerous affairs and her, as it's called, unashamed sexuality?
Well, I'm sure there's always someone to criticize about this. So, yes, I mean, she was, but she also lived in an era just after the French Revolution when it wasn't too unusual. I mean, she wasn't completely unlike other people, of her milieu in Paris at the time. And she was criticized for wearing men's clothes and, you know, going around in pants and dressed as a guy and smoking in public and for some of her opinions. She was also criticized for her political opinions because she was a socialist and very interested in justice and freedom. And so she got criticized for other things as well as her sexual behavior and seems to have weathered it pretty well. Really. But she was also very much admired by the people she lived with in the country who, you know, saw a different side of herself.
How did you begin to write Maria, sort of the parallel story?
Well, that was difficult because I didn't know who she was to start with. I wanted a contemporary woman. I wanted her not to be me. I couldn't think whether she was going to be English or American for a while. It neither worked. And in the end, I made her Scottish, which I lived in Scotland for 12 years. And that suddenly seemed to gel. You know, I suddenly saw her as a person rather than a sort of aspect of myself, a different person, a character, and came to life as soon as I put her in Edinburgh, which I knew well, and began to imagine her life there. So, but that came much later. It was difficult to get Maria somehow. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's some discussion about that 19th century women found a way to be freer than 21st century women. Talk about that.
Well, Maria gets to wonder that, you know. How did George Sand, she sort of went around with various famous men. I mean, if Françoise Sagan said something about this, she said that if she had been off with various famous men of her generation on trips, you know, everybody would have known about it. Well, even more so now. I mean, you can't move, you know, if you're a famous writer and you take off with a famous musician, you know, the gossip thing starts up immediately. Everybody knows exactly what everyone's doing. So she had more freedom and privacy in a way than we do now, and which immediately means you're freer, I think. I don't know if that answers your question.
It does. It does. With all of our talk about work-life balance, do you think that we're more or less fulfilled now than our historical counterparts?
Well, I think it depends who we are. I mean, you know, there have always been women who've done what they wanted in different eras, and that's a lot geared to class background and freedom from poverty. I mean, you know, people in George Sand's day, women in France weren't living great liberated lives if they were stuck in their villages bearing children, you know. But there are always some sort of people who carry the torch, and because they have certain privileges, probably they also are educated. That makes a difference. But probably more women now, I should think, than in the 19th century on the whole, are living fulfilled lives. But we're still racked with guilt and angst and worry about this, that, and the other. So
for her truly bohemian lifestyle, was she actually a good mother?
Well, she was. She took her children with her on her trip to Mallorca. She was a very loving mother and grandmother. And she had her grandchildren to stay at her, you know, later in life. She became rather a sedate person, actually. She didn't die till she was in her 60s. And she had this other aspect to her life of being a good neighbour, she went back to the country and, you know, as I say, her children and her son lived with her for a long, long time. She fell out with her daughter, who was a difficult person. But the daughter kept dumping the grandchildren on her, and she loved her grandchildren. So she was, you know, she wasn't always just this free spirit rushing around Europe with famous men. She had this other side.
Did she have sort of famous female friends too, other writers in England, for example?
That's a good question. You know, I don't think she connected with anybody in England, as far as I know, but I've never thought about that. She had women friends, yes, close women friends in Paris. And yeah, I'm not sure about the English connection.
Without giving away the ending of your book, I mean, in your opinion, who had the happier ending, Maria or Georges?
Well, you have to look at the... I mean, George's whole life, you know, we know what happened to her, and we know she died in extreme pain. She could have had, if she'd been alive today, she could have had surgery and been saved. You know, she died of an obstruction of her stomach, which really could have been dealt with today. And Maria, well, she stays in the book, she stays in her 40s, so we don't know what happened to the rest of her life. George divorced her husband and lived alone in the last part of her life. She didn't have... I mean, she had various men with her during her life. Hard to say. I think that there are pressures in the 21st century which simply didn't exist in the 19th on people.
Yeah.
You know? And that's what I think at the moment, anyway.
What are you working on now?
Well, I'm working on another novel. And it's a little hard to talk about it in case I sort of jinx it, so I'm not going to do that.
Thank you so much for stopping by. The book is a wonderful read. Congratulations.
Well, thank you very much. I'm so glad you enjoyed it. And I just hope people will enjoy it. I think I'm right to give, you know, hope people will have a lot of pleasure in reading. It shouldn't be a chore. It should be just fun and you know, get in there. Yeah, thank you.
It is a great read. Thank you.
Many fans of Louise Penny's Chief Inspector Gamache series are making her newest title, A Trick of the Light, one of Amazon's top mystery and thrillers for the year. Hearts are broken, Lillian Dyson had carefully underlined in a book. Sweet relationships are dead. But now Lillian herself is dead. The book was found in Clara Morrow's garden in Three Pines, shattering the celebrations of Clara's solo show at the famed Musée in Montreal. Chief Inspector Gamache, the head of the homicide at the Sûreté de Québec, is called to the tiny village, where he finds the art world gathered, and with it, a world of shading and nuance, shadow and light. Behind every smile lurks a sneer. Every relationship there seems to hide a broken heart. When the facts are slowly exposed, it is no longer clear if the inspector has found the truth or simply a trick of the light. Ralph Cosham narrates.
Clara would have smiled had she not been fairly certain she was about to throw up. Oh, no, 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 she thought again, as she watched Peter march purposefully toward the closed door and the art wraiths waiting to pass judgment. On her. Clara's hands grew cold and numb as she moved slowly forward, propelled by an undeniable force, a rude mix of excitement and terror. She wanted to rush toward the doors, yank them open and yell, "Here I am!" But mostly she wanted to turn and flee, to hide, to stumble back down the long, long, light-filled, art-filled, marble-filled hallway, to admit she'd made a mistake, given the wrong answer when asked if she'd like a solo show at the Musée, when asked if she'd like all her dreams to come true. She'd given the wrong answer. She'd said yes. And this is where it led. Someone had lied, or hadn't told the whole truth. In her dream, her only dream, played over and over since childhood, she had a solo show at the Musée d'Art Contemporain. She walked down this corridor, composed and collected, beautiful and slim, witty and popular, into the waiting arms of an adoring world. There was no terror, no nausea, no creatures glimpsed through the frosted glass, waiting to devour her, dissect her, diminish her and her creations. Someone had lied, had not told her something else might be waiting. Failure. Oh, no, 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 thought Clara. Still the dead one lay moaning. What was the rest of the poem? Why did it elude her? Now, within feet of the end of her journey, all she wanted to do was run away home to Three Pines, to open the wooden gate, to race up the path lined with apple trees in spring bloom, to slam their front door shut behind her, to lean against it, to lock it, to press her body against it and keep the world out. Now, too late, she knew who'd lied to her. She had. Clara's heart threw itself against her ribs, like something caged and terrified and desperate to escape. She realized she was holding her breath and wondered for how long. To make up for it, she started breathing rapidly. Peter was talking, but his voice was muffled, far away, drowned out by the shrieking in her head and the pounding in her chest, and the noise building behind the doors as they got closer. "This is going to be fun," said Peter, with a reassuring smile. Clara opened her hand and dropped her purse. It fell with a plop to the floor, since it was all but empty, containing simply a breath mint and the tiny paintbrush from the first paint-by-number set her grandmother had given her. Clara dropped to her knees, pretending to gather up invisible items and stuff them into her clutch. She lowered her head, trying to catch her breath, and wondered if she was about to pass out. "Deep breath in," she heard. "Deep breath out." Clara stared from the purse on the gleaming marble floor to the man crouched across from her. It wasn't Peter. Instead, she saw her friend and neighbour from Three Pines, Olivier Brûlé. He was kneeling beside her, watching, his kind eyes life preservers thrown to a drowning woman. She held them. "Deep breath in," he whispered. His voice was calm. This was their own private crisis, their own private rescue. She took a deep breath in. "I don't think I can do it." Clara leaned forward, feeling faint. She could feel the walls closing in and see Peter's polished black leather shoes on the floor ahead, where he'd finally stopped, not missing her right away, not noticing his wife was kneeling on the floor. "I know," whispered Olivier, "but I also know you. Whether it's on your knees or on your feet, you're going through that door." He nodded toward the end of the hall, his eyes never leaving hers. "It might as well be on your feet." "But it's not too late." Clara searched his face, seeing his silky blonde hair and the lines only visible very close up. More lines than a 38-year-old man should have. "I could leave, go back home." Olivier's kindly face disappeared, and she saw again her garden, as she'd seen it that morning, the mist not yet burned off. The dew heavy under her rubber boots, the early roses and late peonies damp and fragrant. She'd sat on the wooden bench in their backyard with her morning coffee, and she'd thought about the day ahead. Not once had she imagined herself collapsed on the floor, in terror, longing to leave, to go back to the garden.
That was A Trick of the Light by Louise Penny. Another book topping Amazon's best mystery and thriller list for this year is Sister by Rosamund Lupton. Their bond was unbreakable. The truth was unimaginable. When Beatrice receives a call to say that her sister Tess is missing, she boards the first flight home. But as she learns about Tess's disappearance, she is stunned to discover how little she actually knows of her sister's life. Everyone around her accepts that they have lost Tess, but Beatrice refuses to give up. She embarks on a dangerous journey to discover the shocking truth, whatever the cost. The title is performed by Juanita Mann.
It's funny what surprises me now. Often it's the smallest things. For instance, yesterday a paper had a story on how close we have always been as sisters and didn't even mention the difference in our age. Maybe it doesn't matter anymore now that we're grown up. But as children it seems so glaring. 5 years is a big gap. People would say, who didn't know, a slight rise at the end of their sentence to frame it as a question. And we'd both think of Leo and the gap he left, though maybe gaping void would be more accurate. But we didn't ever say, did we? The other side of the back door, I can just hear a journalist on her mobile. She must be dictating to someone down the phone. My own name jumps out at me. Arabella Beatrice Hemming. Mum said no one had ever called me by my first name, so I've always assumed that even as a baby they could tell I wasn't an Arabella. A name with loops and flourishes in black inked calligraphy. A name that contains within it girls called Bella, or Bells, or Belle. So many beautiful possibilities. No. From the start, I was clearly a Beatrice. Sensible and unembellished in Times New Roman, with no one hiding inside. Dad chose the name Arabella before I was born. The reality must have been a disappointment. The journalist comes within earshot again, on a new call, I think, apologising for working late. It takes me a moment before I realise that I, Arabella Beatrice Hemming, am the reason for it. My impulse is to go out and say, sorry, but then you know me. Always the first to hurry to the kitchen the moment Mum started her tom-tom anger signal by clattering pans. The journalist moves away. I can't hear her words, but I listen to her tone, appeasing, a little defensive, treading delicately. Her voice suddenly changes. She must be talking to her child. Her tone seeps through the door and windows, warming your flat. Maybe I should be considerate and tell her to go home. Your case is sub judice, so I'm not allowed to tell them anything till after the trial. But she, like the others, already knows this. They're not trying to get facts about you, but emotions. They want me to clench my hands together, giving them a close-up of white knuckles. They want to see a few tears escaping and gliding snail-like down my cheek, leaving black mascara trails. So I stay inside. The reporters and their entourage of technicians have all finally left, leaving a high-tide mark of cigarette ash on the steps down to your flat, the butts stubbed out in your pots of daffodils. Tomorrow, I'll put out ashtrays. Actually, I misjudged some of them. Three apologised for intruding, and a cameraman even gave me some chrysanthemums from the corner shop. I know you've never liked them.
But they're school uniform maroon or autumnal browns, even in spring, you said, smiling, teasing me for valuing a flower for its neatness and longevity. Often, they're really bright colours, I said, not smiling. Garish. Bred to be spotted over acres of concrete in garage forecourts.
But these wilting examples are stems of unexpected thoughtfulness, a bunch of compassion as surprising as cowslips on the verge of a motorway. The chrysanthemum cameraman told me that this evening the news at 10 is running a special on your story. I just phoned Mum to tell her. I think in a strange Mum-like way, she's actually proud of how much attention you're getting, and there's going to be more.
We just heard Sister by Rosamund Lupton. Sue Grafton has the ABCs of creating entertaining mystery novels down pat. I'm sure you've read several of the Alphabet Mystery series starring the one and only Kinsey Millhone. Here's the latest. V is for Vengeance. The story begins as a woman with a murky past kills herself. Or was it murder? Add in a lovely woman whose life is about to splinter into a thousand pieces, a professional shoplifting ring racking up millions in stolen goods, and a spoiled kid awash in gambling debts. At the heart of this spiderweb of dangerous relationships is an elegant but ruthless businessman whose dealings are definitely outside the law. And for Kinsey, her 38th birthday gift is a punch in the face that leaves her with two black eyes and a busted nose. As Kinsey says, I know there are people who believe you should forgive and forget. For the record, I'd like to say I'm a big fan of forgiveness as long as I'm given the opportunity to get even first. Judy Kay narrates.
He imagined a cadre of tax attorneys as well as accountants, financial hotshots, paralegals, and administrative assistants. Dante was under indictment on racketeering charges, and Philip had expected an atmosphere both tense and sinister. He'd worn an expensive sport coat, thinking to show respect. But now he realized the image was all wrong. Everyone he saw wore casual attire, stylish, but understated. He felt like a kid dressing up in his daddy's clothes, hoping to be taken for an adult. The brunette showed him into the office, and Dante leaned forward across the desk to shake hands, then motioned Philip into a seat. Philip was startled by the man's good looks. He was in his mid-50s, a big guy, probably 6'2", and handsome. Soulful brown eyes, curly gray hair, dimples, and a cleft in his chin. He appeared to be in great shape. The warm-up conversation had covered Philip's recent graduation from Princeton, his dual major, business and economics, and his job prospects. Dante listened with apparent interest, prompting him now and then. Actually, nothing in the way of employment had materialized as yet, but the less said about that, the better. Philip spoke about his options, not mentioning he'd been forced to move back in with his parents. That was too lame to bear thinking about. Philip began to relax, though his palms were still damp. Dante said, "You're Trip Lanahan's boy. You knew my dad? Not well, but he did me a good turn once upon a time." "Excellent. I'm glad to hear that. Otherwise, you wouldn't be sitting here." "I appreciate your time. Your friend Eric says you're quite the poker player." Philip shifted in his seat, steering a course between modest and boastful. "I played all through college, starting my freshman year at Princeton." Dante smiled and his dimples flashed briefly. "No need to mention Princeton again. I know where you went to school. Was this high stakes, or you taking change off of a bunch of donkeys at some frat house?" "Actually, I played in Atlantic City and picked up enough change most weekends to cover my expenses." "You didn't work your way through school?"
"I didn't need to."
"Lucky you," Dante said. "Though, just off the top of my head, poker parlors couldn't be the lifestyle your dad had in mind for you."
"Well, no, sir. I expect to work. That's why I got my degree. At this point, I'm just not sure what I want to do."
"But you'll decide soon."
"I hope. I mean, that's certainly my intention."
Under his sport coat, Philip felt his shirt dampen, sticking to his back. There was something fearsome about the man, almost as though there were two of him, the one benevolent, the other pitiless. On the surface, he seemed affable, but underneath, a shadow personality was in play, prickly and sharp. Philip was anxious, uncertain from moment to moment which of the two he was dealing with. Now Dante's smile faded, and the alternate took over. Maybe it was in business matters that Dante became dangerous.
"And you've come to me for what?"
"Eric says you sometimes advance him cash if he's experiencing a shortfall situation. I was hoping you'd do the same for me." Dante's tone was pleasant, but the benevolence didn't reach his eyes.
"A sideline of mine. I lend money to people the banks won't touch. For this, I charge fees and administrative costs." "How much are you looking for?"
10 Dante stared at him.
"A lot of money for a kid."
Philip cleared his throat. "Well, 10, you know, 10 gives me breathing room. That's how I look at any rate."
"I take it Eric explained my terms."
Philip shook his head. "Not entirely. I thought I should hear it from you."
That was V is for Vengeance by Sue Grafton. Lest old acquaintance be forgot, please don't forget to check my website, bookreportradio.com, for more of the top titles and authors of 2011. And don't forget to tune in next week for the Book Report's first edition of 2012. Wow, we have to get used to saying that. From all of us at Book Report Radio, we wish you the happiest of New Year's. So here's the team to send their own wishes.
Hi, this is Derek Hewitt, executive producer of The Book Report, and wishing you happy reading for all of 2012.
Hi, everybody. This is Steve, engineer here at The Book Report. Just want to wish everybody a great holiday and a happy new year.
Howdy, y'all. This is Aaron James, music composer for The Book Report, calling from Austin, Texas, to wish y'all a happy new year.
Hey, this is Oli, studio producer, wishing you happy holidays and a happy new year.
Hey, everybody. This is Dave Hain, the editor of the show, wishing you all a happy and safe new year.
And this is Elaine Charles, wishing you the happiest of New Year's.